So we're really delighted to have our own brother, Lou Santini, come and share with us this morning. Lou is a member of our pastoral council as well, and Lou's going to tell his incredible family story this morning.
Well, thank you all for being here and taking your time and to listen to me. As I'm driving over, I'm asking the Holy Spirit to give me the right words to say to you that might make some difference in your life. Last time we were here at the men's breakfast, listened to Mike Kostolak, and I can tell you that really had an impact on me, telling his miraculous story of the plane crash and whatnot. And that's a lot of why I'm standing here right now to talk to you all. So the title was Faith Conversion Through Tragedy. You know, a lot of titles we could have. I call it spiritual awakening, I guess, at some level. I know many of you, but not all of you, so I'll give you the quick introduction. I've been a parishioner for 20 years at Incarnation. Been blessed to be married to my lovely wife, Janet, who some of you know, for 30 years this year. And thank you. We made it, yeah. And blessed to have three wonderful children. So my daughter is Jenna. She graduated UVA a couple years ago. She's up in Georgetown Hospital working as a nurse in radiation oncology. And that's no accident, sort of how she got into that business. She's coming back in a couple of weeks and is going to UVA to the nursing school to become a nurse practitioner. So very excited about that. My son, Gregory, is 19. He's down at Elon. He survived the semester. He's got two more days. He got into a frat, so that was the highlight of the first year, and so things are going well there. And then our third child is Jeffrey, who is an angel in heaven at this point, and he passed away 6 years ago on April 18. So my story is heavily connected with sort of what was going on at that point. A year ago, I wrote a spiritual autobiography, and this was in a course that I'm taking called Spiritual Direction Institute. I know Ray has been through that with Father Chap Michael. Quite an experience doing, the whole course, but writing a spiritual autobiography. So if you haven't done it, I would highly recommend attempting it at some point. Can be very revealing in terms of yourself. So after thinking long and hard, the first line in my spiritual autobiography was, I can divide my life into two parts, before cancer and after cancer. And before cancer, I sort of go back and say, I was your typical father trying to raise a family, going to work, make a living, being a good provider, running the kids to soccer and doing all those kind of things. Had faith, but it was a different kind of faith. It was sort of God was out there somewhere, what I call an external deity, and removed that wasn't sort of in here. And the other thing is I really felt that I was in control, meaning I could control my destiny, my family's destiny, what happened. And of course, looking back, it was all an illusion. And it was an illusion of self-sufficiency that I operated under for much of my life. So that was my starting point. Now, after cancer, my life changed profoundly for forever and ever. First, my faith was shaken, to its very core, and then this sort of slow, what I'll call spiritual awakening has come about, which continues to this day. And I felt, any of you have seen the movie Shawshank Redemption? It's one of my favorite movies, great movie. So, I looked back as I was thinking about my autobiography, and I said, if you remember, Morgan Freeman played this character, Red, who's a lifer, had murdered when he was a young man, and every year he goes before the parole board. And the parole board is, tell us about what you've done and why should we basically release you from prison? And he has the same response. It's, I'm a changed man. You may not see it on the outside, but I can tell you I'm a changed man on the inside. So I feel a lot like Morgan Freeman there, that I'm a changed man. You don't see it, same guy walking around, going into church most times, going to work, going about my business, but inside I'm a changed person. So I've lived through darkest days that I think I could ever imagine as a father. And it's very strange, because my wife Janet has this saying. She said, you know, it was the worst of times, it was the best of times. And I've always just had a real problem with that issue. I said, I don't believe that. I can't say that. What I can say is I've never felt more alive and present during that year. And looking back, I also know God entered my life in many new ways that year. And primarily it was through the presence of Jesus Christ in my son Jeff's life. I mean, he walked with him, and in my life partially, and then just the many, many gifts of the Holy Spirit that arrived when we needed them during that year. So it's sort of hard to distill what I was going to say. I've thought about this. I thought about it ever since last men's breakfast, sitting here listening to Mike, about what I would say. So I've selected about six sort of key points, inflection points, I call them, events that really highlight some of this transformation of what occurred. So the first was the phone call. The phone call. Now this was, so I'm going to go back to January 03. Jeff played soccer. He was an athlete. His knee hurt. So, you know, knee hurt. We go to all kinds of doctors and orthopedics and just couldn't come up with anything. So long story short, a lot of different doctors, a lot of scans. And then finally, March 3rd, 03, we're sitting at home. We get a phone call with the diagnosis after all the pathology reports and whatever came back of anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Yeah. Had no clue what that meant other than cancer. And that was, shaking uncontrollably, thought I was going to vomit, you know, just this reaction that I had and Janet and then later Jeff. So we try to pull ourselves together, called a family meeting, so got everybody down together in our bedroom. And to this day, we don't know, we, meaning Janet and I, who actually said these words, whether they were together. I insist I did, she insists she did, but who really knows? If you knew Janet, you would understand. So, you know, I said we're going to do four things. We're going to do four things, and the first thing we're going to do is we're going to love each other more than we've ever loved before as a family. And what I can say is, during that year, I learned what unconditional love really was. And I'll say, even before that, with my marriage and all that, there's always, you know, strings attached. There's something going on. You know, that was the year that sort of love became, you know, real and in sharp focus. Second was, we're going to do everything in our power to cure Jeff and bring him back to full health. Now, obviously, we know that wasn't the outcome. But what I can say, and I'll comment a little bit later, that, you know, God works in some strange ways and can create a lot of good out of pain and suffering and tragedy. Third was, we're going to do whatever to keep our marriage strong. Because what we did know, at least enough to say, the stress this is going to put on us, you know, they're typical two reactions. You go apart or you come together. And we made that commitment that we're going to keep our marriage strong. And I can tell you now, 30 years later, our marriage has never been stronger. Awesome. And fourth, I said, we're going to pray and we're going to keep God close to our heart. And again, that was that was the real transformation where that began, that, you know, God was no longer out there somewhere, he was here. So, you know, life became really focused. So when Janet says the best of times, it was all the clutter was removed, our purpose, our priorities, was, you know, this was it. Everything else was either going to drop off the table or just not going to give it the attention. So we did that, you know, Jeff went through the, am I going to die? And then he goes up in his room, and about 10 minutes later, he comes down and says, I know this is harder on you than me. That's what he told us. And then he said, let's go to a movie. And we went to some, I'll call it some stupid comedy. It was Steve Martin and Queen Latifah, whatever. And Jeff loved movies. Jeff loved to laugh. We made a commitment at that moment, too, for as long as it was, we were only going to watch comedies. So, and I like a lot of those dark kind of, you know, intense movies. And so, you know, nothing, just stupid comedies for a year. And so that sort of broke it a little bit. So the second is, once the sort of word got out of what was going on and we started treatment immediately, just incredible support, generosity, love from so many people. You know, starting with family, close friends, going to Incarnation community, my work community, Charlottesville community, people we didn't even know, just being there for us. And I'll tell you, that was hard. That was hard for me as a father to accept, because my life had always been about, I'm in control, I can take care of this, I don't need help. And then when I realized that, you know, people, this was, you know, born of love. I mean, these people that were helping us because they wanted to. So it was very humbling. And for a year, don't think we cooked a meal. I think I managed to gain a few pounds probably during that year. Just people were always there. They were at the hospital. Father Gregory was there in the hospital. He'd bring communion, did the anointing, the sick. Sister Mary, you all remember Sister Mary? Yeah. I mean, she was an angel. She was there all the time, and she had some very deep conversations with Jeff. People became family, you know, Mike Duffy and Tom Hintz, and, you know, just lots of people from all over the place. And when I say God can create good out of this, looking back, that spirit of generosity and giving continued after that time to this day through Jeffrey's gifts. And I won't go into that sort of long story, but because of all of the generosity that Jeff received on his own volition, near the time of his death, he went down his basement and grabbed all of his old toys and Legos and put them in a big grocery bag and brought them down to the hospital and gave them to some kid. So that was the first Jeffrey's gift, and that became the basis of the foundation that we started in his name, that we've been very fortunate to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, but only from the generosity of people in the community and elsewhere. And unfortunately, to brighten the days, these dark days of some of these kids being treated for cancer and their families, that's continued. So again, incredible. Now the next thing I'm going to share is something I haven't shared before with, well, anybody other than a real close family friend, but I thought this forum of Catholic men believers would be the time. And this is, context, about 6 months intensive chemo, Jeff endured, went into remission, you know, things looked somewhat promising over the summer. Almost immediately in the fall, got relapse. So we're in and out of the hospital trying different things in the fall. So now we're getting late fall, we're into December. And Jeff was a model patient, did everything the doctors wanted him. Finally, he blew, you know, which 15-year-old kid at that point, 15-year-old kid. Finally, he just got fed up and screaming, whatever. So, you know, we're at UVA. They send in a psychiatry resident, you know, some 25-year-old kid, you know, and starts asking Jeff all these questions and treating him like he's 10 years old. You know, you want to read some books, you know, and can, you know, you want to talk about some. And Jeff finally, yeah, you want to do something? Knock out that wall, put a big screen TV in, and get the F out of here, and I don't ever want to see you again. Finally, just had it. and then said, I don't want to see anybody unless I ask for them. So things sort of changed. So that was that day. Then that evening, something happened. Janet and I were in the hospital. I actually lived in the hospital in his room for about half of the nights in the year, more than half, in the little cots. Middle of the night, Jeff pops out of bed, eyes open, sort of looking up, and said, I see it. I see it. I see heaven. And started describing. Green rolling hills, beautiful. Did have his big screen TV. But then he said, everybody is there. Everybody loves me. I mean, he's telling us this, you know, about an hour after that. Everybody is there and everybody loves. Now, in our family, we hadn't had, his grandparents were alive. We didn't have a lot of experience with death of people that were close. And Jeff is saying, everybody's there, everybody loves me. And then he tells us, I'm not afraid to die. I'm afraid to live. So this is December 23rd, 03. The next day, our doctor, our primary doc, pulls us in one of the little consult rooms and gives us new news. His cancer had mutated. You know, they had done several tests, sent him up to Johns Hopkins. Cancer had mutated, and basically there's nothing left to do. We were trying to get him in a position to do bone marrow transplant. We were going to go down to Duke, and said, nothing left to do. You know, there were two, you know, every cancer is rare, right, with a child. I mean, this was now in that category of we only know two cases in the world at St. Jude's, and of course, both young men like Jeff, neither survived. Jeff already knew. We didn't have to tell him what was going on. Somehow, he knew from his experience that he had, his vision. And it was a vision. I mean, this wasn't a dream. And you know, and the other thing, just to know, I'm not trying to put, you know, canonize Jeff or put him on a pedestal. He was a regular kid. You guys know. I mean, my friend Mike Duffy. I mean, our sons played soccer together. Jeff was, he wasn't necessarily religious. He wasn't, you know, what you'd call one of these holy kids. He was just a regular kid. But he's experiencing this on his journey. So, a month later. So now that was Christmas. So a month later, we're watching one of these stupid comedies again down in our basement. And, you know, we just did a lot of it, just hung out together. And this time Jeff was not watching TV. He pulled out all of his art supplies. He had done some art earlier in life and it was actually quite good. So the chalk and markers and all this stuff. So he's sitting over there on the couch just intensely scribbling away. And we're sort of glancing. I'm wondering, what's he doing? And, I mean, he was focused. I mean, his tongue was hanging out, you know, concentrating. And about 20 minutes later, he rips this page off and hands it to us. So I did bring a prop. This, what he handed us was this. Now, we've since framed it. I mean, it was a piece of paper. Jesus on the cross.
Wow.
To Mom and Dad, thanks for being here for me always, forever. Signed his name. Jeff. So Jeff had this special connection with Jesus. I mean, Jesus was walking with him on this journey. And, you know, you hear, if you read that, you know, people will write a letter and leave, you know, if they know they're dying, or they'll make a tape, a video or audio or whatever. This is what he chose to leave us. He didn't write a letter. He gave us this. You want to, you know, and it's quite descriptive if you look closely. I'm going to leave it up here if you want to see it afterward. And I'll tell you, I have this on the wall, and every morning when I wake up, first thing I see. So if my house were to burn down tomorrow, and you had to run out and grab, you know, what's your most valuable belonging, first thing I would grab, this. And I have a nice house, I have nice cars, I have nice things. This is probably the most valuable thing that I own, because that was the journey. So the next is what I'll call maybe the single moment that sort of changed my life. And the context here is throughout the whole treatment, I was doing my own independent research. So maybe not unexpected. So I'm on the internet all the time looking for the latest treatment protocols out there, wherever they are, at the leading pediatric cancer centers. I'm having many times heated discussions, debates with our primary doctor. We're very tight, close friends now, but we had a lot of heated moments. You know who she is, a great woman. But I never accepted at face value. So everything was just tested, and that's part of, I guess, my personality. So I'm picking up the phone, and I'm calling St. Jude's, Sloan Kettering up in New York, MD Anderson in Houston, Fred Hutchinson, whatever. The leading cancer centers in the country and then even the world, and tracking down who's your pediatric lymphoma specialist and having conversations with these people about, you know, what's out there, what's possible, here's what we're doing, what do you think, anything else we could be doing. Now, why I tell you this is this would be the furthest thing from my world you could ever imagine. You know, I'm in business, I mean, anything medical, I mean, getting blood, sight of blood, being in a hospital, going to die. I mean, that's the last thing I would ever do. And somehow the Holy Spirit sort of gave me the capacity, I guess, and the perseverance and to just immerse myself in that world. In fact, I remember talking to one of these docs in Paris, because there was some treatment there. And it got to a point where, you know, they thought I was a doctor. And after a while, I didn't even correct them. You know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter because it didn't matter. All that mattered was, is there something out there that is going to work? And it was humbling to an extent. I mean, it's, again, I just hated that whole world. And you guys, and I'm looking at my friend Paul and Tim, I gained so much respect for you all and what you do, because that's real. I mean, you guys are dealing with life and death. And Jean's wife, Christy, she was nurse practitioner, she was one of the prime caregivers also. Just incredible. So I just tell you that for a little background, but so as things got really, really worse. So now we're into, what are we into? February, March, February. I intensify the efforts when they said there's nothing left to do. So what do? I go into a mode of I crank it up. So I'm spending all my time now in the office, on the internet, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to find something. I mean, he's not going to die. Meanwhile, I'm ignoring Jeff and my rest of the family, and they've already sort of over that hump. They're just having a good time. They're going out to lunch, they're going to dinner, they're going out shopping, they're watching movies, they're spending time together, just spending time together, you know, laughing, crying, doing whatever you do. So finally, I come rushing in, and you know, I'm convinced we're going to go down to MD Anderson and we're going to try some salvage kind of therapy. Talk with Jeff, you know, I got this lined up, we're going to go down. Jeff grabs me at the kitchen counter. And Jeff at that time was much bigger than I am. And he grabs me around the back and just said, "Dad, you're missing it." He said, "You know, I love you. I just want to spend time with you. You know, stop, smell the roses. You know, we're having a good time." I mean, he was already there. And that was the moment that he could have hit me in the head with a 2x4. And I said, "Wow, this is what it is. This is all we have. You know, this is, you know," sort of I learned how to live and, you know, talk about priorities at that moment. Now, I sort of got my wits together and I drove up to White's Grocery Store, if any of you know, in Earlysville. I live about 2 minutes from there. And I don't know why. I bought a six-pack of Heineken, bag of potato chips, French onion dip. I came back, sat at the counter, popped open a couple beers, and just had some father-son bonding time, and we laughed. And because I knew that never have that opportunity again. That was it. And so the next 3 months, or whatever it was, about 3 months, we just were together. We had a good time. Again, we laughed and cried, and it was. I mean, then I can truly say it was the best of times, the worst of times, because never felt more alive at those months. Probably have never had better months in my life than those couple months. Because you realize that, you know, that's what's important. So the last situation was coming to the very end. Okay? I mean, very end. The night before he died. Now, I'm telling you this now in retrospect. The docs, the hospice doc said, oh, he's got a couple months to live. You know, we had brought him home. He had a couple really, really rough weeks in the hospital, but the what we wanted was him to pass away at home. And that's what he wanted more than anything. So the night before he passed away, late at night, he came to Janet and I and said, I don't want to disappoint you. You know I want to keep fighting. I mean, I'm a fighter, but my body just can't keep going. So basically he sort of resigned himself to that. And one of the hardest things I ever had to do in my life was to say, Jeff, that's okay. You know, God is with you. God will take care of you. To basically let him go. You know, not say, no, Jeff, don't die. I mean, at that point, that was what was left. And then, you know, sometime later, I'm reading the Bible and one of the passages, and I don't know which one, where Jesus is in the garden getting ready for the passion, and he said, the spirit is willing, but the body is tired. And again, that was, I'm thinking, that connection Jeff had walking, Jesus walking with Jeff on that journey of pain and suffering. And the next day, I'm going to say everybody was there, family, grandparents, Father Gregory was there, happened to be there, didn't know what was the outcome. Andy McFarlane was there, hospice nurse was there, and this was, Janet got in bed with Jeff, I'm holding his head. Jenna, a daughter, Gregory are on the side. Jenna's holding his hands with all kinds of love. Our dog is under the bed. And Father Gregory started singing this song, Abba Father, you remember? And that was a song that Janet used to sing to Jeff all the time to calm him down. And just that slow, methodic thing. And at the moment before he takes his last breath, and I haven't ever told anybody this, Jeff's laying in bed, raises his arm, and just the presence of Jesus Christ was in that room at that moment. I felt it. I knew it. There was electricity in the room. Actually, Jant was shaking. I mean, I've you know, every kind of emotion possible, you know, sadness, relief, I mean, joy at that moment. It was incredible. I mean, I've never experienced anything. I mean, looking back, all we can say it was truly a moment of grace. There's no other way to explain it. So I know, I'm absolutely convinced, I know where Jeff is today. He's home. He's home. We're all going to hopefully be there, home. And we're here on this short journey, and I no longer fear that time, that day, whenever it's time. I'll know I'll be reunited with Jeff. So that was, you know, the year that changed my life 6 years ago. So, you know, like Red in Shawshank Redemption, I'm a changed man, all right? You just may not see it. So I've been on this journey for 7 years now, searching for answers and only coming up with more questions. A big question, of course, is why, you know, why Jeff? How can this happen? But I've realized it's not, you know, why Jeff? It's why do these things happen? Why do hundreds of thousands of people die in Haiti? Why do they have earthquakes? Why this tragedy at UVA this past week? And I realized we can't answer that. You know, we can't answer that. I don't know. I'm not in control. I mean, God's in control. Maybe is it his will? I don't know. I fought that for a long time. It took me about 5 years to finally accept maybe it is God's will. But I've realized there are many mysteries that we cannot understand, will not understand. But we can choose to have faith and put our trust in God. So another quote that I don't have it right, but I attribute it to St. Augustine, and I've reworked it, I guess, my way, is, you know, faith is believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse. To come to accept that that's our time here. You know, we can choose to believe. We probably can't understand a lot of these things that go on. So after a lot of searching, reading, contemplating, I do consider myself a disciple of Christ now. But I've chosen the path of St. Francis, who told his followers, I learned this from your wife, when he said, go preach the Gospels at all times, and when necessary, use words. So I've chosen to live my faith rather than talk about it. But I've changed, you know, many ways on the inside. I mean, one, I've mentioned several times that I feel a deep personal relationship with God. It's no longer out there. It's here. It could have been easy to walk away. In fact, it was tempting. But instead, I chose to find comfort in Jesus Christ. And you know, finally, I said, if I don't have faith, I have nothing. I am nothing. You know, there's nothing left. So I also feel that just in the way I live my life has changed. I feel a more caring, open, compassionate person. Other people have commented on that. And just more tolerant. But at the same time, I can tell you I'm much less tolerant of all the, and I'm going to say the bullshit that goes on in the world, the pettiness that people get into. I just don't have time for it. Don't, you know, the political stuff, I just stay away from it. On the outside, I told you my marriage has never been stronger. My professional life has gotten much better. You know, I used to be on this track. I needed to go up, and I wanted that top job, and I deserved it and everything else. That ain't important. I mean, I realized that redefined my professional life is to help people be better leaders in business, help organizations be more successful. And I'll tell you, it's opened up all kinds of new opportunities for me that I wouldn't have had if I were just on that single track, mindless focus. I volunteer more of my time. I've gotten, you know, more involved. I mean, I used to be the person out in the bleachers there most Sundays, right? And, you know, became a catechist, started working with teenagers, got into the confirmation, small groups, sponsored a number of young men on their journey for confirmation. It's been great. And then finally, as Father Gregory mentioned, somehow I ended up on the pastoral council. And it wasn't because I rose my hand and said, hey, I'm ready to do this either. It was, I think I was called to do this. So that's, you know, why I'm here. And more so, I'm taking this course now, the Spiritual Direction Institute. So I know, Ray, you've taken it, and anybody else taken that course? I'm 1 year in, you know, just reading everything I can get a hold of, just these great spiritual works. And it's really been wonderful, just opening up my whole horizon and mind. But I never would have thought I would do that. I mean, that, I could say that might have been a foreign world, not as much as the medical world to me, but probably something that I wouldn't have done. So, you know, it's going to sound trite if it wasn't true, but I'll say I'm a much better person now for what I went through. And at the same time, I'd trade it all in a second to have my son back and, you know, just live in a little bubble and mindless bliss, you know, and not know any better. So, you know, why have I decided to use my words now? I mentioned at the beginning that last men's breakfast, Mike Kostolak was sharing his miraculous story, and it did. It hit me because I felt the connection. So I'm walking out in the parking lot, and all of a sudden I see Father Gregory there walking toward me, and I walked up to him and I said, "I'm ready." And he said, "Ready for what?" I said, "I'm ready to share my story." And I think you said, "I was just going to ask you that." So again, it was the Holy Spirit came down, called to be here standing in front of you. So I want to just conclude with another quote, some words that would be far better than anything that I could come up with. And this is Elie Wiesel, who is a Holocaust survivor, author, I think psychiatrist, author of many books, including one called Night. And this was a book, a little thin book, that Jeff was reading early in his treatment, because he was doing homeschooling while he was in treatment in a hospital. And he read this book like in an hour, a couple hours, and gives it to me, that you got to read this. And this is a story of the Holocaust and sort of how it transformed him since. And quite profound, but at his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, he said this: "For those of us who have experienced the kingdom of night, every moment is a moment of grace, every hour an offering. Not to share them would mean to betray them. Our lives no longer belong to us alone. They belong to all those who need us desperately." So, thanks for listening.